Thank you for downloading the Beacon Podcast. Today's episode is about government structure. Are you curious about government structure? I know I am. We have quite a few gems in place. We hope you enjoy. Sit back, relax, and enjoy yourself.
The Beacon Podcast.
They haven't succeeded in getting the guns out of the hands of the American people, nor have they succeeded in taking our freedoms away. In fact, there's been a great awakening in this country and a big backlash against these Marxist, communist, puke-faced, lying, subversive, Nazi, jackbooted Gestapo thugs that is gaining momentum. And so I can tell you with a certainty, they must do something terrible in order to stop this backlash and regain the sympathy of the mass herds of sheeple out there. And I'm telling you, one of the things that will give us the moral high ground and will begin civil war is the day that they begin declaring martial law across this country, taking guns out of the hands of the American people, and rounding up American patriots. The war will start on that day. On that day. And there will be a war in this country, a civil war to restore, not a revolution, but a civil war to restore constitutional Republican government. Now, at the same time that that's going on, communist and Marxist underground forces will begin, or try to begin, a revolution in order to institute a Marxist, socialist, or communist government as a result of the Civil War. So we, patriots, will be fighting on two fronts. On two fronts. And you'd better understand which side you're going to be on. Restoration, revolution, or tyranny. I'll be fighting with the forces of restoration, and so should you better be.
Yeah, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking 2 more years of this, I'm gonna chuck it in and move to an easier place. You're thinking $2 a liter doesn't really look that far away. And you're thinking as you look at your ring finger, is that really the right decision? Oh yeah, yeah. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking if I'd just been given a chance to express myself, develop my inner guru, then I could be that gorgeous, tan, blonde, 19-year-old, boring, sickly, black, holy water down my throat. Right now, in digital widescreen perfection, I know what you're thinking.
This song is a jam. This guy's getting it.
No more, no ever.
He says, I know what you're thinking. They don't want you thinking, so think.
Hey, I like that.
you're thinking. You're thinking one more day of this and I'm gonna break, bust out and make a mistake I could regret for the rest of my life. Oh, I don't know what I'm thinking.
Anyways.
Nice little groove.
Yeah.
Good call on that one, Matt.
Guys, that is Think by Mammal. Think by Mammal. If you like it, go check it out. Show them some love. Buy their album. This is how capitalism's supposed to work. If you like it, buy their shit.
Support it.
Don't be stingy. Stingy people never end up in good places in life anyways. Donate to people that you like. If people are providing good work, throw them a kickdown. That's just the way it goes. I'm not saying to do that for us because, honestly, I could care less. We're not that type of people, so we've been taken care of very well in life. Things just happen good to us. So, anyways, just a little word, a word of wisdom out there. But having said that, we think that if you guys do want to support anything about the show, you guys do like the show, the first thing that you guys could do that would really help us out is hit us up, let us know. It's very encouraging to get some of your guys' response, some of your guys' feedback. You can, what you got there, Nick?
You could hit us up on Twitter at Beacon Podcast. That's one of our favorite ways. I mean, we get a lot of messages that way.
That's,
it's
yeah,
fun, favorite. Quick to, you know, while I'm taking a dump, I sit there, check out Twitter and say
and
what's
fast.
Up.
It's fast. I'll get it that
it's
day.
Fast and quick and easy. Yeah, the email is great. Also, we got a email recently from a really awesome person who's motivated by some of the shows we've done and has helped him in learning in college, like, you know, how he perceives the knowledge that he's been given, you know, which is great. You can hit us up on Facebook at The Beacon Podcast, and our email is thebeaconpodcast@gmail.com. And love it or hate it, or if you have some ideas on show information or just some questions or whatever, you want some new kind of thoughts on things, we'd love to hear from you.
Absolutely. Also, you probably are listening to this. It sounds like most of the people are getting our content on iTunes, but not everybody has an iPhone. So if you don't, we're also on Stitcher. Just search for The Beacon Podcast. Look for our logo with the earth and the moon with the circle and the square. We'll explain what that means on a later show. Gets into some cool, crazy shiznit. Also, it has come to our attention that on iTunes and Stitcher, our shows earlier than our episode, I think number 13 or 14, are unavailable. So until we get that kink worked out, if you guys want to hear the shows previous to that, and there's great shows, we always refer to our Money Monopoly show. We always refer to our Socialist Utopian Delusion show, because they are foundational in a lot of the knowledge that we need you guys to have as we move forward with some further, we progress upon our knowledge. If you guys want to get those other shows, you can still get them on your home computer. You can get them on your smartphone, your tablet, just as easy. Just go to your web browser and enter in thebeaconpodcast@blogspot.com. And you will get our blog. And on our blog is playable versions of all of our shows. And if that doesn't work for some reason, go to feeds.feedburner.com/thebeaconpodcast. I'll repeat both those. The first one was thebeaconpodcast@blogspot.com. The second one was feeds.feedburner.com/thebeaconpodcast. It's also come to our attention that Facebook is starting to, and Twitter are starting to censor their content. And so we have multiple avenues that our content can get out there. So we want you guys to know early before shit gets too crazy, because if history is any indicator, shit's going to get crazy.
Now I feel like a dick for promoting Twitter. Damn,
well,
it.
Yeah, it still works. Ours still works.
But there's a new website coming out similar to Twitter, right? A new app?
There is. It's called Gab.
And yeah, we were thinking about trying that out.
Yeah, I'm going to actually, I should put that on my list of things to do this week. I'll try to open up a Gab account for the Beacon podcast. How you doing, buddy?
Doing great. Holidays are over. Well, we have one more left. We have New Year's. But it comes by quick, don't it? You know, like, I'm just thinking about all this food I ate. You know, I think I need to have a few more salads for a couple days here.
Oh,
my stomach.
Some weight.
Dude, I've had so much red meat, it's not even funny.
Yeah, same here. Red meat.
For but it's sure. bomb, you know. I love it.
I had a grass-fed, grain-finished boar's head ribeye this afternoon that the whole thing tasted like butter, man.
Where'd you get that from?
There's a Ben's Corner, like meatery.
Oh, okay.
On the corner there. And they have that type of.
What's grain finish mean? They eat grain at the before they kill them.
So there's a lot of like modern like agriculture really kind of feeds a lot of these cattle like crap. There's actually an agricultural grade candy now that they're feeding animals just to get them fat. They just want to fatten them up. The problem is they get health problems, and those health problems, a lot of those like genetic markers get. They're in the meat. Then because they're sick, they have to give them antibiotics. They end up giving them hormones to make them bigger. And then there's this big cascade of health issues where if it's a healthy cow for all of its life, you don't have that problem. They're supposed to eat grass.
Mm-hmm.
They're grazing
natural.
Animals.
Yeah.
And so if you have them out in the sun and you give them good, healthy grass that haven't been fertilized and that kind of stuff, they're going to be healthy cows. But the meat's going to be really lean and not that, like succulent.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is they feed it grass its entire life so it's healthy. And they don't have to feed – they don't have to give it medicines or anything because it's healthy. And then a couple months before it goes to the butcher, they grain finish it. So then they feed it those grains that fatten it up. And it's living a happy-ass life right before it dies.
Yeah.
It doesn't have the health issues because a lot of those are long-term issues. Doesn't get disease, but you get, like, the best, like, the meat's just bomb. The meat is great, and it's good for you.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a big meat eater. Like, I'm just so lucky I'm not a picky eater. I've never been. I'll eat anything, but I don't know. You do got to mix it up. You know, I've been eating red meat like crazy, and then when I'm not eating that, I was eating pizza, pepperonis, and stuff.
Ooh!
So my stomach's like hating me right now.
So if Nick has to like jam out to the restroom.
Yeah, you're a door slam quickly.
When he sends me the hand signal, I'll take a quick break. I'm like, we gotta go.
Have you ever seen that video online? Speaking of cows, real quick, it's milk in reverse from the table to the udder, like
milk. Like
they start. It's like. A glass of milk on your table, but then it goes and rewind, and it goes, you know, into the gallon of jug, and then into the thing, and
okay.
Then it shows these ugly pussy udders getting sucked on, and sick cows getting milked, and this and that is just it'll gross you out. Don't watch it if you like milk to drink.
So
milk.
That's modern farming.
Mm-hmm.
There is like if you had a cow, like I agree. There's probably disgusting ways that like your Altadena or something gets their milk, right? Like
yeah.
The major ones. But that's another thing that we're trying to do. Like, not with the Beacon podcast, everything's got to get localized, not just governmental structure and power, like political power should get localized, done on the local level, but so should our eating.
Yeah.
Everything should go back local. And if they do that, you're not going to have big, huge, you know, like 1,000-acre farms that just grab cows by the neck and put them into a udder extractor or whatever, you know, like. Yeah, that's hell, and we should not put up with that. You vote with your money. You vote with your dollars. So even if it costs you guys a little bit extra, you know, pay for those home farms where it's like hand milked. Any like major town is going to have one or two places, hippie places that have that kind of stuff. I love that kind of food, and I think it's a lot better for you. I think it treats your body better, your brain better. I'm in on that. I would pay double for that kind of food. I really would.
Yeah, if you can, yeah. I mean, I've had, my aunt grows a lot of vegetables and stuff, and if you get a tomato from her garden, or you go to Albertsons or Vons and get a tomato, it's night and day, the flavor. Oh, yeah. I mean, flavor. they go bad faster, you know.
For sure.
Like, you got like 3 or 4 days. Yeah, like 3 or 4 days, it's you got to eat it.
Yep.
But, man, I get a tomato from the store, and it's like, this is disgusting. It's no flavor. Mm-hmm. You know, no, yeah. Barely ripe.
For sure. I think bacteria is kind of my gauge. Like, mm-hmm. if bacteria really want something, it's really, really good for you probably, right? Like, if there was 2 pools of water in the African Serengeti, and one pool of water had a bunch of animals in it, and one pool of water didn't have any animals in it, which one would you want to drink out of? You would think that the other one has pure water, but there's a reason these animals ain't fucking with that pool of water, right?
Yeah, alligators are in it.
No. It's somehow been poisoned.
Yeah.
There somehow. There's different, you know, like a lot of like really sterile water is like ones that have like fissures from the earth come up through it, and so it's like too sulfuric, or there's the minerals that leach in it are like make it really like
the salt and sea.
Balanced the salt and sea. You don't have animals drinking out of the salt and sea.
The place reeks, man.
Anyway, sorry, but I totally think that's why your organic veggies and fruits go bad way faster.
Oh yeah, like, it's right after you pick them off the plant. It's dying.
Bacteria are like, ooh, this is some bomb ass food. Let's get some
nutrients.
Anyways, Nick, we got to get started on this show because we have a lot of content. This show, guys, is about governmental structure. And the purpose for doing this show is because, kind of like we've done in the past, is in order to build into certain ideas, they'll get a little bit complex. But you can't look around and understand the world that you live in if you do not understand some of these complex ideas. And the only way to understand the complex ideas is to understand their foundations, which are more simple ideas. So once in a while, we have to do an elementary type show just so we cover all of our bases. And that way, when we come across when we start teaching on some of those more complex ideas, we can refer back to shows like this and say, if you need a primer on some of this content, please listen to our governmental structure episode. So stay along. I guarantee you there'll be stuff that you don't know about the United States governmental structure that we do cover. So there's going to be some gems that are in this, and we're make it as cool as we can for you guys, okay? I learned a lot just putting this stuff together. So I think the first thing that we really have to grasp is, what is our government? How did it come to be? You had the king who chartered companies to come over to America. He chartered companies to come over to America to build businesses, to mine minerals, and to basically colonize the place. There were 13 colonies, and when they were colonies of England, Great Britain. So you hear about colonization. That was a British thing. That's why they were called colonies. When these colonies had had enough of the king's, it was actually the king violating a lot of the contracts between the king and the people. We'll do another show on that, but that goes back 1,000 years from that, and we can't talk about that this episode. But if you guys want to know about that 1,000 years, look up a woman named Chris Ann Hall, and she has a lecture on YouTube called The Genealogy of the Constitution, where she gets into the 1,000 years before our Bill of Rights was signed, and it talks about the contracts that the people started to have with the king, and how, you know, the Magna Carta, and how when the king started violating these principles with the people. The people could petition the king and say, you fucked up on this, you fucked up on that, we didn't get our religious freedom here. So when the king had violated a certain amount of these, the people in the colonies actually had a legal right based off of their law to have a revolution. And so the states, they got together and they said, okay, this king's been screwing up too much. Actually, the first version of what they did was a loose-knit conglomeration between all of them, and it was called the Articles of Confederation. And they felt, actually, the first thing that they did was the Declaration of Independence. And the Declaration of Independence was like, all right, we're done. You're not fucking with us anymore. And it was a declaration. Hey, we are free men. You violated your contract. So when you read the Declaration of Independence, it's not long. But when you read it with that knowledge in mind. And it's really beautiful. They say, you know, when a government, you know, is tyrannical, then it's the people's duty to rise up and cast off its oppressors. And So after that, they had the Articles of Confederation, which made a loose confederation between the states. But as England decided to mount an attack against America because of that Declaration of Independence, they felt like they needed a stronger confederation, which is when the Constitution comes into play. Okay? So that's kind of some interesting history that people, most of the time people hear these documents as being synonymous, but there's a timeline that they actually happened. So the states got together and they signed a compact. The states got together and they signed a compact. A compact is a contract. It's a legal contract. That legal contract made the federal government. They got together and they made the federal government. The federal government's jurisdiction was limited to 10 square miles. That's called Washington, D.C. And they can legislate whatever the fuck they want in those 10 square miles. People don't know this. They can't legislate whatever they want
nationally
in the states because the states own their own states. Each state became its own country. Actually, a state back then was the name for a country. Germany was a state. France was a state. Germany wasn't a state yet. France was a state. England was a state. So Georgia was a state. Florida was a state. They were their own countries. They formed a union, which is like the European Union or something like that. So think of it like that. Does that make sense?
Totally.
Any questions there? But it's a different way of looking at it than what we've been taught, right? We haven't been taught really anything regarding that.
No, the way we've been taught is, oh, these old dudes came off a boat and they wrote this paperwork and, you know, one of them had syphilis and the other one fucked slaves and
that's it.
And that's it, yeah. And they're, but they're geniuses.
So, Article 1, Section 8.
And like to fly kites.
Yeah, and like to fly kites. Yeah. Article 1.
Fourth grade version, syphilis and kites.
Section 8, Clause 17 is proof. When I say that the federal government can only write laws within that 10 square miles, they can't write laws that apply to the other. I shouldn't say that. They can write laws that apply to the states if those laws follow the Constitution. If they don't follow the Constitution, they can only write laws that apply within those 10 square miles. Then they can write whatever the fuck they want. Within Washington, D.C., it's essentially a tyranny. So here's how it reads in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. The legislative branch has power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square, as may, by cession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of the government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be, for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. So what it's saying is that the federal government can do whatever the fuck it wants in those 10 square miles of Washington, D.C., but outside of that, it has limited power regarding its relationship to the states. So the states made the federal government through contract, and the Constitution is the contract. And the only way that the federal government can write whatever the fuck it wants is within those 10 square miles. Within those,
but what's 10, the benefit of that? I mean,
because here's, it gets tricky. Within those 10 square miles,
that's not very big.
It's not, but here's the sinker.
Overreach.
Those 10 square miles have a name. That name is the United States. Okay? Capital U, capital S. Now we get into law. When you talk about the lowercase U, lowercase S United States, it's describing all of the states coming together, being united in this compact.
Mm-hmm.
But when it says the United States, like you are a citizen of the United States, what that really means is you are a citizen of those 10 square miles. And they can legislate whatever they want to you if you're a citizen of that.
Hmm. That's where my brother lives.
So a lot of people don't know this stuff.
That's crazy.
It gets crazy then. And people wonder how they have the right to violate some of your Bill of Rights. That's one of the ways that they've taken power. So, in certain cases, states allowed the federal government to control over certain things. Everything else, when the federal government writes a law that applies to the states and is against the Constitution, it's actually null and void. Okay.
So, do you not have constitution, like your rights in those 10 square miles? You don't have constitutional rights, or
unless they give them to you. That is not a state. It's an independent plot of land. It has its own constitution. It does not have a Bill of Rights.
Yeah, I've heard that before. It has its own constitution. It's its own.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but we got to start thinking of this stuff correctly in order to have a proper perspective on how our countries run. Okay. Mm-hmm. So as a guarantee to the ratification of the government, what that means is, in order for all the states to vote for this constitution to be valid, there's a few things that worried a lot of people in when they were forming this document. And they said, in order for us to feel comfortable signing this, we need a Bill of Rights. And so the states crafted the Bill of Rights to become the first 10 amendments. And those first 10 amendments are paramount above all the others. And those 10 amendments, they don't tell you what the federal government, the newly created federal government, is allowed to take it, or with those rights that it gives you. It's declaring your natural rights by virtue of being a human. And some of them say God-given rights, and for the atheists, they say nature's God. Yeah. Whatever nature's God is, those rights.
Natural law.
Natural law. That's the right to be free, and it lists those 10
so we all gotta
amendments.
Eat. You know, you can't make a law against, you know, hunting, even though they do. You have to have a fucking license to hunt or fish or whatever.
Life, liberty, the pursuit of
But if you're going to die and you need to survive...
Yeah,
I think there's been a lot of cases where people were like, hey, I was hungry, I had to eat, I had to forage.
Well, that's the Ninth Amendment. The Ninth Amendment says just because we didn't cover all of your freedoms in these first 10 amendments in the Bill of Rights doesn't mean that those aren't all of your natural rights.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Ninth Amendment. Super important amendment.
And don't be a douche.
And don't be a douche. So now that we know that, we can kind of go forward with describing the government structure, because if we just went right into the government structure, it wouldn't make as much sense. Now it makes way more sense having that background. So the first thing we're going to talk about, when they wrote the Constitution, they broke it up into Now, remember, all of this is talking about the federal government. Ultimately, the states have ultimate power.
Mm-hmm.
They only signed this compact in order, just for a few things. And the major reason was so that they could combine enough money to be able to build a navy and fight off England's navy. That's the main reason that they did this. So, in the federal government, the first branch we're going to talk about is the judicial branch. They made three branches. They made the judicial, the executive, and the legislative. The judicial is the court system. The legislative system is the one that writes all of the laws. And the executive system is the one that carries out all of those laws. Okay?
To execute
all the laws. So the judicial branch. And we're going to be getting a lot of this information is from a website called usgovinfo.about.com. It put it all this stuff in really easy to understand terms, so we're just going to read this for you guys. The only federal court provided for in the Constitution, Article 3, Section 1, is the Supreme Court. All the lower federal courts are created under the authority granted to Congress under Article 1, Section 8 to constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court. So, the only one is the Supreme Court that's granted to the judicial branch. Other than that, Congress can make courts below that. Congress is in the legislative branch.
Okay.
The Supreme Court justices are appointed by the President of the United States and must be confirmed by a majority vote of the Senate. And that's a simple majority. That's 51%. So in order to become a Supreme Court justice, which is a judge, the Constitution establishes no qualification for Supreme Court justices. Instead, nomination is typically based on the nominee's legal experience and competence, ethics, and position in the political spectrum. In general, nominees share the political ideology of the presidents who appoint them. Their term of office is for life, barring retirement, resignation, or impeachment. Since 1869, the Supreme Court has been comprised of 9 justices, including the Chief Justice of the United States. When established in 1789, the Supreme Court had only 6 justices. During periods of the Civil War, 10 justices served on the Supreme Court. So one of those is the Chief Justice, and sometimes it's incorrectly called the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, but his real name is the Chief Justice of the United States. We already talked about what the United States was. Yeah. He presides over the Supreme Court, and he serves as the head of the judicial branch of the federal government. The other 8 justices are officially referred to as associate judges of the Supreme Court. Other duties of the Chief Justice are assigning court opinions by the associate justices and serving as the presiding judge in impeachment trials held by the Senate. Senate does the impeachment trials. So the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. When we start getting into law, you're going to have to know what jurisdiction means. Jurisdiction means an area that court has power over. If it's not in their jurisdiction, they don't have power over it. So there's like that. It gets a little complicated. We'll get into it. The Supreme Court exercises jurisdiction over cases involving the U.S. Constitution, federal laws, treaties, and maritime affairs. That's affairs that are on the sea. Matters concerning U.S. ambassadors, ministers, or consuls, cases where the U.S. government or state government is a party, disputes between the states, and interstate relations, federal cases, and some state cases in which a lower court's decision is appealed. The lower federal courts, these are the ones that were established by the Senate. The very first bill considered by the United States Senate was the Judiciary Act of 1789. This divided the country into 12 judicial districts called circuits. The federal court system is further divided into 94 Eastern, Central, and Southern districts. So you have 12 circuits, and within those 12 circuits, you have 94 districts. And those are geographically spread across the country. Within each district, there's one court of appeals, a regional district court, and a bankruptcy court. The lower federal court include the court of appeal. Sorry, we just said that. Judges of all federal courts are appointed for life by the President of the United States with approval of the Senate.
Why for life? Why isn't it like a term or something? Yeah.
That's a we'll get into that on another show. One whole show we're just going to devote to the judicial branch because there's a lot of people, and in this book, there's a lot of people
holograms of liberty.
That think that the Constitution has certain holes in it in order to eventually give that federal government more power over time, and they think that that's one of them, is that the president appoints them and that they serve for life and that there's no term limits on it. So that's a good question.
Yeah, they could be a douche.
Could be.
Could be a douche president, put in his douche buddies.
Could be. Now, they can be impeached.
Fuck yeah.
The Senate can vote to impeach him. So if they're that bad, they can be impeached. I think it's a 2/3 vote in the Senate.
Did you think Scalia's death was a little shady? Like, they didn't seem to like investigate it enough. It was like, oh, guy's dead, fucking out here.
I didn't look into it enough. You know, yeah. I know he was like a fairly more conservative, and I've seen a few of his speeches, but I don't know. I'm not sure. Federal judges can be moved through office only through impeachment and conviction by Congress. So that's our thing on the judicial branch. But as an addition, we're going to talk about, so this judicial branch, we talked about their responsibilities. Nowhere in those responsibilities, originally in the Constitution, did they have the power to declare a law unconstitutional and they're the sole arbiters of truth, constitutional truth. That's nowhere in there. We're going to talk about where that came from. Nick?
In Marbury versus Madison.
So this was the first case where they established something called judicial review.
In Marbury versus Madison in 1803, the Supreme Court announced for the first time the principle that a court may declare an act of Congress void if it is inconsistent with the Constitution. William Marbury had been appointed a justice of the peace for the District of Columbia in the final hours of the Adams administration, when James Madison, Thomas Jefferson's Secretary of State, refused to deliver Marbury's commission. Marbury joined the three other similarly situated appointees, petitioned for a writ of mandamus, compelling delivery of the commissions. Artfully aged and anything but ordinary, who do you sip your bourbon? Oh, I'm sorry. How do you sip your bourbon? What the heck is that about? Oh, that's a fucking advertisement. Should have crossed that shit out. How do you sip your bourbon?
This is brought to you by Jim Beam.
I don't sip it. I chug it. Sorry about that, everybody. Fuck. That's stupid. Anyways, Chief Justice Marshall, writing for a unanimous court, denied the petition and refused to issue the writ. Although he found the petitioners were entitled to their commissions, he held that the Constitution did not give the Supreme Court the power to issue writs of mandamus. I feel like I said that wrong.
Mandamus.
Yeah, mandamus. Mandamus. Mm-hmm. Section 13 of the Judiciary Act of 1789 provided that such writs might be issued. But that section of the act was inconsistent with the Constitution and therefore invalid.
Yeah, so what was happening was there was two groups. It was kind of your Republicans versus Democrats back in the day. The people that wanted less government were called the Anti-Federalists. The people that wanted more government were called the Federalists. Adams was a Federalist president. He was like a Democrat. He was leaving office because Jefferson had just won, and Jefferson was an Anti-Federalist. Adams, because he knew he was leaving office, he decided to stack the Supreme Court with a bunch of Federalist judges. Yeah. And Marbury was a Federalist judge. And so he was stacking the court with a bunch of Federalist judges. The person that was supposed to give him his commission, which is basically tell him, here you go, you are a judge, was a guy named John Marshall, who, when the administrations changed, he became the chief justice of the Superior Court. He left being Secretary of State. He was supposed to give that. The new Secretary of State was James Madison. James Madison was told by Thomas Jefferson, hey, I'm the new president. That guy hasn't been appointed yet. I'm the president. Don't appoint him. Mm-hmm. So Marbury and a few other judges that didn't get their commission decided to appeal to the Supreme Court to have them make Madison give them their commission. And Marshall was in charge of the court. They tried to do it through that writ of mandamus. It's called the writ of mandamus. It's a court order that makes people do something. Okay. John Marshall ended up saying, we can't make him deliver that commission because it's unconstitutional. So they were the first to declare that something was unconstitutional. And after that, ever since then, everybody's been turning to the Supreme Court to declare things constitutional or not. It was never originally their job. Okay. Most people don't know this. So everybody, you're taught in school even, that the legislative branch writes the laws, the judicial branch determines the constitutionality of the laws, and the executive branch carries out the laws, as long as it passes the judicial branch. Not true in the Constitution. You can't find it in there because it's not in there. It's only through that case that the precedent was established. It's not law. It's not true. That's why states have the right to nullify an unconstitutional law, even if the Supreme Court deems it constitutional. Make sense?
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because I've heard that before, where any law that is deemed unconstitutional is therefore not a law. You know, like out here in California, if I wanted an AR-15 that's fully automatic, you know, even it's a law here, you know, I still have my Second Amendment rights. Yep. And if I was to be caught with something that's unregistered or whatever, no, I have the right to bear arms.
That's why it's so important that we know this stuff. That's why it's so important. The judicial branch is not supposed to be the sole arbiter. So what they found out in that case is that the John Marshall, the judge, he said this, and this phrase gets through the last couple hundred years has been construed wrong. He said, it is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. Now, if you read that closely, he's not saying we're the sole person to say what the law is. He's just saying we can declare something unconstitutional. Any court can declare something unconstitutional. Any state can declare something unconstitutional. You and me can declare something constitutional. All he is saying is that it's within the court's ability to declare something unconstitutional. Absolutely. But people take that as him saying, we're the sole arbiter of constitutionality. Mm-hmm. And since then, that's how they got the power of judicial review. It's a lot, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to do a whole show or try to just fit it into a segment. We will expand on that. But I'm going to leave it there, actually. I'm going to leave this other part for when we actually do a show on it, because I don't want to confuse people. And we got to take a break. So you got any questions about that? Are you ready for a break?
Yeah, appreciate it. Yeah, it's all good stuff, man. This is a good way to break it down, I think. You know, I think looking at it 1,000 years ahead of time, how it started, was a cool way too.
Oh yeah, we have to do that. It's an interesting story because it goes into the Pope pushing the King of England around, and the King of England decides to fight back, and the people are on the Pope's side because everybody back then was on the Pope's side, and the Pope actually the Pope actually like threatens the king with his like with his land and his people, and that's how the Magna Carta was signed. But it was just nuts. It's really interesting history.
I always side with the people with crackers and wine.
Yeah, that's true. Me too. Especially back
then. Or grape juice.
I don't think that they even back then, like there was not good ways to purify water, and so the only people that like water would make you sick. So everybody was drinking wine and like fermented alcohol because it's the only way that you could actually have like a safe like thing to drink.
Hmm.
Like poor people and really rich people would drink water, and the rich people would have not filtered, but probably boiled or something, but they're the only ones that had water quality good enough to drink. Hmm. That's crazy. I don't know why you wouldn't want to just drink wine, but maybe it gets old after you do it for like 30 years.
Yeah, you need water because it dehydrates. You need water, bro.
All right, man. We will take a break. We're going to get into next the legislative branch.
Ooh, wait.
Maintains its subconscious edge as old worry maintains your consciousness. There's a loser in my house and a puppet on a stool and a crowded way of life and a life reflecting fool. And as the people read, the moral fabric dies, then country and pretender nor its people's cries. You are the government. You are jurisprudence. You are the militia. You are jurisdiction. And I make a difference.
Wow, that was a fast song. Fast break. I just looked at the clock. I was like, do I have time to take a piss? No, I don't. We're going to get right into it. Now we're going to talk about the legislative branch of the government. This is still the federal government. So, there are two branches of the, there's two parts of the legislative branch. That's why when you look at the Capitol building, there are two sides to it. In one of them, you have the Senate. And in one side, you have the House of Representatives, okay? The House of Representatives is directly elected by the people, and the Senate is originally was elected by the state legislatures. So the Senate would have been represented the state's interests, and the House of Representatives would have represented the people's interests, and that those interests could kind of battle each other. It's kind of very similar to the English system where you had I think it's called a House of Commons and a House of Lords. You had the powerful people in one house and you had the laity, like the poorer people in another house. And because they have different needs and they have different wants, but both all should be represented in different ways. And some are more educated than others and have a little bit more forethought and kind of know what they're talking about.
One wants to be rich, the other wants to stay rich.
Yeah. Wanting.
How's it feel to want, motherfucker?
So the House of Representatives, the one that represents the people, this is known as the lower house of the legislative branch. The House of Representatives currently has 435 members. Each member gets one vote on all bills, amendments, and other members brought before the House. And other measures brought before the House. The number of representatives elected from each state is determined by the state's population through the process of apportionment. Each state must have at least one representative. Apportionment is recalculated every 10 years according to the census.
Would you want that job?
Census? Hell no.
No, like the being the state's representative.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I've thought about it. I'm like, if I wasn't such a goofball, I would definitely do that. And I would just go mainline Constitution every single time.
Yeah, Section 2, Article 5, says there is a no goofball clause.
Damn it. Well,
I'm surprised you didn't know that. That started 1,000 years ago. That's
Members of the House represent the citizens of their local congressional districts. Representatives serve 2-year terms with elections held every 2 years. So that's something good to know, too, is the House of Reps is 2 years. In order to be in the House of Reps, as specified in Article 1, Section 2, you must be at least 25 years of age, you have to be a citizen for at least 7 years, and you have to be a legal resident in the state that you're elected to represent. So what powers do the House have? They actually vote on who's going to get impeached. They vote on charges of impeachment. They also, and this is the most important power given to any of the three branches, is they have the power to initiate bills involving the raising of revenue, such as tax bills and annual appropriations or spending bills of the annual federal budget. So you'll hear that the power of the purse lies in the House. That's what it means. Everything having to do with money has to originate in the House of Representatives. Can't originate with the president, can't originate in the Senate, definitely can't originate in the courts, has to originate in the House. Why? Because the people have to say where their money goes.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as the House leadership, there's a Speaker of the House, and currently that is Paul Ryan. He's the Speaker of the House. Usually that's the majority. Whatever party has the majority, they elect their speaker. So it's Paul Ryan. He's a Republican from Wisconsin.
He's not the orange guy that cries.
No, yeah. That's not. That's Donald Trump. Yeah.
No, that was the previous one.
There's the majority leader. This leads the majority party. So the House is broken down then into, if there's more seats in it that are Republican or more seats in it that are Democrat. Right now there's more seats that are Republican, so they call that the majority. So you've got the majority leader, and the Republicans voted for him. That's Kevin McCarthy of California. And then you have the minorities. There's less Democrats in the House. And so the minority leader is Nancy Pelosi. She's a Democrat from California. They have different jobs. I'm not going to get into that because it doesn't really matter. But yeah. But they basically just kind of schedule floor debates, and they formulate their responses together. And then when they end up going into committees, that's kind of where some of those majority and minority leaders have a bigger part. So that was the House of Representatives. Let's go to the other side of the Capitol building, and that is the U.S. Senate. The U.S. Senate is known as the upper house of the legislative branch. The Senate is currently comprised of 100 senators. You get 2 for each state. Senators represent all citizens of their states. Now they do. Remember how I originally said that they are supposed to represent the state legislatures? Well, the 17th Amendment changed that. Now they're elected by popular vote. And when you're elected by popular vote, you actually represent the interests of the people.
Mm-hmm.
So there, and that's a whole other thing. Listen to our episode called Republic or Democracy if you want to know more about that.
I'm always interested like how these people get to this point, though. Like, because they make bank.
They make, I have it, $174,000 a year.
Not bad. But I mean, I don't know what your thoughts on Joe Biden are, but he never comes off like that much of an intelligent guy ever. Like, he's just like regular old dude. Like, I seen him on Jay Leno's garage the other day. It's like, okay, well, he likes, you know, hot rods and stuff like that. But I'm like, how did he become the fucking vice president?
Money.
Yeah.
Money. There's corruption. And when some of these secret societies end up getting shit on one of their members, and you get shit on people through a bunch of different ways. You'll have parties and get people fucked up and have them do crazy shit and film it. And they got all sorts of crazy ways to do this. Then they get blackmailed. And a lot of the secret societies,
it's dirty.
They'll fuck yeah. They blackmail these guys, and then they have them do their bidding. And a lot of times, when you see somebody really like smashed in the news, they might not be playing ball anymore.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, this is how we do. This is how we do ya, you know. And that's how this thing works.
Yeah,
it is. So senators serve for 6-year terms, with 1/3 of senators elected every 2 years. Qualifications in order to be a senator, as outlined in Article 1, Section 3. And guys, if you haven't read the Constitution, take 20 minutes. You can download the app. You can buy a pamphlet. Just read it. It'll make more and more sense the more you do this stuff. But if you guys don't read it, you don't know it, and it's the foundation of how to get our freedom back. Okay, you have to be at least 30 years old. You have to be a U.S. citizen for at least 9 years. And you got to be a legal resident in the state that you're elected to represent. Here's the powers of the Senate. They get to try the officials that the House decided to impeach. Remember, we said the House gets to see who to impeach. They get to do the trial of them. They get to confirm presidential nominations, including the Supreme Court justices. So, like right now, we hear about Donald Trump, and he's going to try to pick who's in the Supreme Court. He doesn't get to pick them. He gets to nominate somebody, but the Senate actually gets to vote them in or not. And that is through a... I think it's a 2/3. No, it's a simple majority. Simple majority, 51%. So if he selects somebody and 51% of the Senate vote for him, they are justice, which is why there's that game between Republican and Democrats. He's pretty much, Donald Trump is guaranteed to get his justice in because the Senate is majority Republican right now. Mm-hmm. They help nominate federal judges, ambassadors, and cabinet secretaries. And they also ratify treaties. Usually ratification is 2/3. Senate leadership. So the actual leader of the Senate is the vice president. He serves as president of the Senate. Then down from him, you have the president pro tempore. So right now, the vice president, we know who that is. That's fucking Joe Biden. The president pro tempore is Orrin Hatch. He's a Republican out of Utah. Below that, then you start to have the majority and minority leaders. And they do a similar thing as in the House. Similar roles as in the House. So what happens when that's the legislative system. And they call that a bicameral system because it's got the two houses. What happens is when they want to make a law or write a law, it has to originate in either the Senate or the House. And if it has to do with funds, it has to originate in the House. They propose it, and then it goes through something called the Congressional Committee System, where those majority and minority leaders figure out which committee will debate it first. And then it has to go through these committees, and it goes through a series of committees before it can get voted on by the whole House or the whole Senate. Then it has to get passed by both the House and Senate in order to go onto the president's desk. And Nick's going to... Sorry. I'm going to read that segment, but... Before any bill is even debated by the full membership of the House or Senate, it must first successfully make its way through the congressional committee system. Depending on its subject and content, each proposed bill is sent to one or more related committees. For example, a bill introduced in the House allocating federal funds for agricultural research might be sent to the Agriculture, Appropriations, Ways and Means, and Budget Committees. like all those committees, plus others as deemed appropriate by the Speaker of the House. In addition, both the House and Senate may also appoint special select committees to consider bills relating to specific issues. Representatives and senators often try to be assigned to committees they feel best serve the interests of their constituents. For example, a representative from a farming state like Iowa might seek assignment to the House Agricultural Committee. All representatives and senators are assigned to one or more committees and may serve on a variety of committees during their terms in office. The congressional committee system is the quote-unquote burial ground for many bills. A lot of bills will come up and they decide to just they just don't pass these committees and they just die in committee. Like you hear about that song, like, I'm just a bill. Remember him? He's like, while I'm dying in committee. That's what he's talking about. So the House of Representatives and the Senate, when you're talking about both of them, it's called Congress. I didn't know that, you know, up until like a couple years ago. Somebody at work was like, what's Congress? Is it the House or the Senate or which one? Congress is when you're talking about both of them combined. House of Representatives, Senate, both. Our Congress. Nick, you want to talk a little bit more about this congressional committee system?
Yes. The congressional committee system is where the action really takes place in the U.S. lawmaking process. Each chamber of Congress has committees set up to perform specific functions, enabling the legislative bodies to accomplish their often complex work with more quickly with smaller groups. Sorry. There are approximately 250 congressional committees and subcommittees, each charged with different functions and all made up of members of Congress. Each chamber has its own committees, although there are joint committees comprising members of both chambers. Each committee, going by chamber guidelines, adopts its own set of rules, giving each panel its own special character. The standing committees in the Senate are standing committees for agricultural, nutrition, and forestry, appropriations, which hold the federal purse strings and is therefore one of the most powerful Senate committees, armed services, banking, housing, and urban affairs, the budget, there's commerce, science, and transportation, energy and natural resources, environment, and public works, finance, foreign relations, health, education, labor and pensions, homeland security, and governmental affairs. And they're also involved in judiciary affairs, rules and administration, small business and entrepreneurship, and also veterans affairs. These standing committees are permanent legislative panels, and their various subcommittees handle the nuts and bolts work of the full committee. The Senate also has four select committees charged with more specific tasks: Indian Affairs, Ethics, Intelligence, and Aging. These handle housekeeping-type functions, such as keeping Congress honest or ensuring the fair treatment of American Indians. Committees are chaired by a member of the majority party, often a senior member of Congress. Parties assign their members to specific committees. In the Senate, there is a limit to the number of committees on which one member may serve. While each committee may hire its own staff and appropriate resources as it sees fit, the majority party often controls those decisions. The House of Representatives has several of the same committees as the Senate, like agricultural, appropriations, armed services, the budget, education and labor, also foreign affairs, homeland security, energy and commerce, judiciary, national resources, natural, my nose is clogging up, science and technology, small business, and veterans affairs. Committees unique to the House include House Administration, Oversight and Government Reform, Rules, Standards of Official Conduct, Transportation and Infrastructure, and Ways and Means. This last committee is considered the most influential and sought after House committee, so powerful that members of this panel cannot serve on any other committees without a special waiver. The panel has jurisdiction over taxation, among other things.
That's Ways and Means. So the Ways and Means is the one where a lot of the financial stuff in the House has to originate. When it has to do with that, it goes to the Ways and Means Committee.
Their areas of interest are printing, taxation, the Library of Congress, and the U.S. economy. Committees in the legislative process, most congressional committees deal with passing laws. During each two-year session of Congress, literally thousands of bills are proposed, but only a small percentage is considered for a passage. A bill that is favored often goes through four steps in committee. First, executive agencies give written comments on the measure. Second, the committee holds hearings in which witnesses testify and answer questions. Third, the committee tweaks the measure, sometimes with input from non-committee members of Congress. Finally, when the language is agreed upon, the measure is sent to the full chamber for debate. Conference committees, usually composed of standing committee members from the House and Senate who are considered the legislation, also help reconcile one chamber's version of a bill with the others. Not all committees are legislative. Others confirm government appointees, such as federal judges, investigate government officials or pressing national issues, or ensure that specific government functions are carried out, like printing government documents or administering the Library of Congress.
Nice. So then we understand then how when a bill gets presented in the House or the Senate, it has to go through committees, and the committees all talk, all discuss it, and kind of vote on it before it can be presented to the full chamber for a full vote. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to actually describe all the steps in the legislative process from a bill all the way up to law. Doesn't it seem like we're sometimes taking one step forward in growth while we're taking two steps back into decay? Doesn't it? Doesn't
Absolutely. It?
Speaking of taking two steps back into decay, let's talk about the United States legislative process. This is how bills become laws, all right? through its constitutionally granted powers, the United States Congress considers thousands of bills each session.
I'm sorry, real quick. Sorry. How many more fucking laws do we need around here? If you're a free fucking people,
yeah,
don't kill me. Don't take my shit.
Yep.
Leave me the fuck alone, and yep, we're all right.
Yeah. It's supposed to be tough to get a new law through. Supposed to be tough. So you see on the news when they're like, yeah, and so-and-so's, you know, the Republicans are holding us up, you know, or yeah, the Democrats are holding us up and they're not letting us get our bills through or whatever. It's like, yeah, that's how it's supposed to be, dude.
Yeah.
You're not just supposed to be able to write a billion bills. Are we, you know? So, yeah.
What do you think about executive order? I mean, that's where we're going to go. I don't want to go off a tangent, but then you got our president just signing off executive orders like it's some other fucking nothing.
That's what this next section of mine is about.
Ooh-wee.
It's called Legislative Powers of the President of the United States. We will get into that.
Well, I mean, and like I said, I don't want to go off on too many tangents, but like people are freaking the fuck out about Hillary or Trump. And don't get me wrong, I don't like either. I wasn't not a fan of either one of them either, but it's like, the fact that we're afraid that one person has that much fucking power over yeah, our lives,
yes,
we need to really look in the mirror as a country.
See, so you have a correct viewpoint of our government and how it's designed and how it's supposed to be. You understand that it's sick for people to think that the president holds that power.
But anybody else I've told that opinion to thinks I'm a fucking nutbag.
I know. Like, well, you're not a nutbag and we're proving it. You're not a nutbag. We're proving it. And you, this is stuff that you can go back with and go, look, he was never supposed to have that much power. So we'll get into that.
Am I a goofball? You're a goofball, right?
Yeah, you're not a goofball, but okay, you're not
damn, we're both
idiot
goofballs? What a chance.
Goofball has nothing to do with intelligence or being right or wrong. So when it says a session of Congress is 2 years. So the United States Congress considers thousands of bills each session, yet only a small percentage of them will ever reach the top of the president's desk for final approval or veto. Along their way to the White House, bills traverse a maze of committees and subcommittees, debates, and amendments in both chambers of Congress. The following is a simple explanation of the process required for a bill to become a law. Step one, introduction. Only a member of Congress, either the House or the Senate, can introduce a bill for consideration. The representative or senator who introduces the bill becomes its sponsor. Other legislators who support the bill or work on its preparation can ask to be listed as co-sponsors. Important bills usually have several co-sponsors. Four basic types of legislation, all commonly referred to as bills or measures, are considered by Congress. Those are bills, simple resolutions, joint resolutions, and concurrent resolutions. That's outside the scope of this talk to get into, but just so you guys know. A bill or resolution has officially been introduced when it has been assigned a number. Okay? Now, when you hear a bill is either going to be HR something or S something. What that means is it either originated in the House of Representatives or originated in the Senate.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So, HR number for House bills and S number for Senate bills. And it's printed in the Congressional Record by the Government Printing Office. Step two, once it's assigned a number, introduction up to assigned a number, with either HR or S, step one. Step two, committee consideration. We talked about the committees. All bills and resolutions are referred to one or more House or Senate committees according to those committees' specific rules. Make sense? That's step two. Step three, committee action. The committee considers the bill in detail. For example, the powerful House Ways and Means Committee, which we talked about with the budget, and Senate Appropriations Committee will consider a bill's potential impact on the federal budget. It's a lot of work. If the committee approves the bill, it moves on in the legislative process. Committees reject bills by simply not acting on them. Bills that fail to get committee action are said to have died in committee.
As I'm dying in committee. But I hope I'll be a Beale someday. Oh, yes, I hope and I pray.
Is this a cartoon or something that you're talking about?
You never seen Schoolhouse Rock?
I think I did remember this. And he's all depressed sitting on the stairs. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's all, this is how a bill becomes a law. All right, step four, subcommittee review. The committee sends some bills to a subcommittee for further study and public hearings. Just about anyone can present testimony at these hearings. Government officials, industry experts, the public, anyone with an interest in a bill can give testimony, either in person or in writing. Notice of these hearings, as well as instructions for presenting testimony, is officially published in the Federal Register. So if you guys are wanting to do research on that kind of stuff, that stuff's going to be located in the Federal Register. Step five, called markup. If the subcommittee decides to report and recommend a bill back to the full committee for approval, they must first make changes and amendments to it. This process is called markup. If the subcommittee votes not to report a bill to the full committee, the bill dies right there. Step six, committee action, reporting a bill. The full committee now reviews the deliberations and recommendations of the subcommittee. The committee may now conduct further review, hold more public hearings, or simply vote on the report from the subcommittee. If the bill is to go forward, the full committee prepares and votes on its final recommendations to the House or Senate. Once a bill has successfully passed this stage, it is said to have been, quote-unquote, ordered reported, or simply reported. Step 7, publication of the committee report. Once a bill has been reported, a report about the bill is written and published. The report will include the purpose of the bill, its impact on existing laws, budgetary considerations, and any new taxes or tax increases that will be required by the bill. The report also typically contains transcripts from public hearings on the bill, as well as the opinions of the committee for and against the proposed bill. Step 8, floor action, legislative calendar. The bill will now be placed on the legislative calendar of the House or Senate and scheduled in chronological order for floor action or debate before the full membership. The House has several legislative calendars. The Speaker of the House and House Majority Leader decide the order in which the reported bills will be debated. So that's where those jobs come into play. They decide the order. So there is a little bit of corruption that can exist in that also. The Senate, having only 100 members and considering fewer bills, has only one legislative calendar. Step 9, debate. Debate for and against the bill proceeds before the House, the full House and Senate according to strict rules of consideration and debate. So now it's gone through the subcommittees. It's been printed. Now it gets debated in on the full floor. Step 10, voting. Once debate has ended and any amendments to the bill have been approved, the full membership will vote for or against the bill. Methods of voting allow for a voice vote or a roll call vote. Am I the only one that thinks voice vote is fucking stupid? Have you ever seen those?
Yeah, because I think you're gonna be more appealed to, like, well, everyone else said it's good, I think.
Not just that. Have you seen them done? On C-SPAN, they'll be like, okay, this is going to be a voice
say
vote.
Say I.
I'll say this, say yay. And it'll be like, ray. I'll say nay, ray.
Okay, nay's okay, got the vote.
Got the vote. Yeah, have you seen
it? It's almost exactly the same,
dude,
yeah.
And I'm like, you got to be kidding me on that one. But that's
yeah, can you count that? Yeah, that's. So. Let's say have like a speaker like that can tell you how who's got, if there's more or louder.
It should all be roll call votes. A vote is a vote. It shouldn't, how loud you scream should not matter, right?
Yeah.
That's just one of the things I thought was kind of silly. Step 11, the bill is referred to the other chamber. So if it arose in the House, then it gets referred, if it passes, it gets referred to the Senate. If it arose in the Senate and it passes, it gets referred to the House. Bills approved by one chamber of Congress House or Senate, are now sent to the other chamber where they will follow pretty much the same track of committee to debate to vote. The other chamber may approve, reject, ignore, or amend the bill. This other one is step 12. This is called the conference committee. This kind of, I didn't know about this. If the second chamber to consider a bill changes it significantly, a conference committee made up of members of both chambers will be formed. The conference committee works to reconcile differences between the Senate and House versions of the bill. If the committee cannot agree, the bill simply dies. If the committee does agree on a compromised version of the bill, they prepare a report detailing the changes they've proposed. Both the House and Senate must approve the report of the conference committee, or the bill will be sent back to them for further work. A lot of work getting these bills done. Step 13, final action, enrollment. Once both the House and Senate have approved the bill in identical form, it becomes enrolled and sent to the President of the United States. The President may sign the bill into law. The President can also take no action on the bill for 10 days while Congress is in session, and the bill will automatically become law. If the President is opposed to the bill, he can veto it. If he takes no action, veto it is basically he denies it. If he takes no action on the bill for 10 days after Congress has adjourned their second session, the bill dies. This is called a pocket veto. So let me describe this. That gets a little confusing, right?
Yeah, he doesn't have to sign shit. He doesn't have to dog it or sign anything. He just, by it being,
well, there's,
by not addressing it, it vetoes it.
It's tricky. The president can either sign the bill into law or veto it. So it either becomes a bill
or ignore it after a certain absence.
And there's two things that he can do if he ignores it. If he ignores it and Congress is in session, then it becomes a law.
Oh, shit.
If he ignores it. So they voted on it. If he ignores it after 10 days and they're in session, it can become a law. If he ignores it and they're out of session, it doesn't become a law, and that's called a pocket veto.
That's so it's crazy.
Yeah, that's just kind of a trick in the law. Like you might see on the news a pocket veto. That's when he ignores it, but Congress is adjourned. So he may
be Congress, playing golf or on vacation.
He
like 30 fucking vacations.
He may, but so Congress, it behooves Congress to pass laws when they know he'll be able to be in office to sign it, you know. And if he's being a stickler and he doesn't want to sign it,
he can wait till they're on a recess or
stay in around
Christmas time, or yeah,
or they stay in session.
Oh, okay,
if they stay in session
and they're getting paid by the hour or what,
it becomes law, and what they want goes. There's a bunch of different ways to kind of play that.
Yeah, but I mean, are they're getting paid salary, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is not the original intention.
But I'm just saying, like, I don't want them to be inspired to say, hey, we could just hang out here until he fucking gets back from vacation and get paid fucking double time, overtime, whatever the fuck, you know.
Yeah, they do that a lot.
And rip off.
They always give themselves. But
oh, absolutely, yeah.
Now, there's a
they have the best interest
there, you know, where they just won't get voted back in, maybe, or something like that. But, so, step 14 is if the president does veto a bill, whether it be a signed veto or a pocket veto, this is about overriding the veto. Congress can attempt to override a presidential veto of a bill and force it into law, but doing so requires a two-thirds vote by a quorum of members in both the House and Senate. So they have to have a certain amount of members present to vote. And of those members present, they have to have a two-thirds vote. Under Article 1, Section 7 of the U.S. Constitution, overriding a presidential veto requires both the House and Senate to approve the override measures by two-thirds supermajority vote of the members present. Whenever they say supermajority, it's always just all that means is more than simple majority. Simple majority is 51%. Anything over that is considered supermajority. Hmm. So most of the other times, it's always going to be either two-thirds or three-quarters for a supermajority. Actually, there's one case where it's three-fifths. The supermajority vote of the members present. Assuming that all 100 members of the Senate and all 435 members of the House are present for the vote, the override measure would need 67 votes in the Senate, that's two-thirds, and 218 votes in the House, which they did their math wrong because they just did simple majority on that. But anyways, doesn't affect the content of what we're saying. So that is how a bill becomes law. Now, makes way more sense. Proposed, put into committee, debated in committee, sometimes sent to subcommittee. Subcommittee sends it back to upper committee. Subcommittee interviews people, experts, sends it back to committee. Committee votes on it, sends it to full. Full votes on it, sends it to other chamber. Chamber sends it. It goes through the documentation stuff, goes to the president's desk. President approval, not veto, pocket veto. Possible override of veto. Boom. That's how it becomes. Pretty cool. You want to take a break or you want to get into your section?
We got a few sections left. I was just thinking about it'd be funny to be the guy on the fence about something, you know, 51% or whatever.
Yeah.
And how many times they'd probably be like, God damn it, Carl. You fucking said you're going to vote for our shit. You know, like one guy. You know, it all come down to one person's just going, eh.
You asked if I would like to be on the House. That's why I would love to be that guy. Because I would always be the one being against everybody else, especially nowadays.
Yeah.
Especially nowadays. I'd be like, don't follow the Constitution, and guarantee you, if you guys follow this through, it's going to make shit worse. I'd be like I'd just get a target little buzzer.
That'd be cool.
I don't know. Yeah, but we need more people that are just willing to get in there and say, no,
like, what the fuck
government's
are we doing?
Grown enough.
Yeah,
no.
Exactly.
Unless it's a law that takes away from other laws, then I'd vote yes for it probably.
So we're talking about the executive branch of the U.S. government. The President of the United States, where the buck really does stop. The President of the United States is ultimately responsible for all aspects of the federal government and for the government's successes or failures in fulfilling its responsibilities to the American people. So that goes back to what we were saying earlier. I guess I was fucking wrong. I mean, one person can make a fucking big difference. I mean, it's scary. Like, it's not a government of the people.
He's got certain powers.
Qualifications. As specified in Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, the president must be at least 35 years of age. Hey, I could do that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 35. Must be a natural-born U.S. citizen.
I was and born what natural. That, there's actually a definition to that. That means that your parents have to be U.S. citizens. Both.
And fucked missionary style. That's more natural.
That cracked me up right there.
Yeah.
Good job.
Not in a car. Must have been a resident of the United States for at least 14 years. And the powers, the constitutional powers granted to the president are enumerated in Article 2, Section 2. Serves as Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Armed Forces. Signs bills passed by Congress into law or vetoes them. Makes treaties with foreign nations. Requires the approval of the Senate. That requires it. Appoints Supreme Court justices, lower federal court justices, ambassadors, and cabinet secretaries with the approval of the Senate. Delivers an annual State of the Union message to a joint session of Congress, which is always amazing.
That's both houses. A joint session of Congress is both houses in Congress.
Folks. Oversees the enforcement of all federal laws and regulations. Sure he does. Can grant pardons and reprieves, for all federal crimes except in cases of impeachment.
Now, pardons and reprieves for all federal crimes.
Federal.
Like, not
so
state crimes.
Turkeys are committing a lot of crazy crimes.
You know, there's county crimes, there's state crimes. He can do only the federal ones. And that goes to say because he doesn't have
10 square miles.
Yeah, exactly.
Legislative power and influence. While the founding fathers intended that the president exercise very limited control over the actions of Congress, mainly the approval or vetoing of bills, presidents have historically assumed more significant power and influence over the legislative process. Many presidents actively set the nation's legislative agenda during their terms of office. This is funny, like, our president now, none of this really seems to...
No. Yeah.
Yeah, really, you're paying attention to so much shit. You're on the golf course fucking every day. Whatever.
That's going to be, like, an extension on this episode. We're going to kind of talk about the some of the perversions that have happened in this original system.
Hey, I'm going to hang out with fucking Kim and Kanye, motherfucker. More important things to do. Got to prioritize.
Kobe.
For example, President Obama's directive for the passage of health care reform legislation. When they sign bills, presidents can issue signing statements that actually modify how the law will be administered. Presidents can issue executive orders, which have the full effect of law and are directed to federal agencies that are charged with carrying out the orders. Examples include Franklin D. Roosevelt's executive order for the internment of Japanese Americans after the attack on Pearl Harbor, Harry Truman's integration of the armed forces, and Dwight Eisenhower's order to integrate the nation's schools. Interesting. Electing the president, the Electoral College, that was our last show. Mm-hmm. Should we hit that? Or
No, we don't have to. That's our last show if you guys want to know about
check out the Electoral College. You have electors. You just go take time off work and get a sticker. And put it and make sure you tell everybody, put it on your coffee cup and put it on Instagram that you voted. That's what everybody does.
Be proud. You did your
civic got a sticker duty. Motherfucker,
you did your civic duty.
You have electors for that.
So funny.
People are keep like, your ass.
I voted. They remind me of Ralphie on
you
the
you can't
Simpsons.
Say shit because if you don't vote you don't have a voice, so how can you complain if you don't vote?
I'm like, you know what, I could not have. I did vote. But I could not have voted, and guess what? I still have a motherfucking voice, because look what I'm doing. We got a fucking podcast. Yeah. We got a voice. How dare people?
Removal from office. Impeachment. If you get your dick sucked, you're getting impeached. Doesn't say that, actually. Under Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution, the president, vice president, and federal judges can be removed from office through the process of impeachment. The Constitution stipulates that conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors represent justification for impeachment. Awesome.
I think we can Why don't skip we that fucking rest push of that them. Impeachment thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know, I think we should be more vigilant of it as a society. Like
that it should be a widely done thing. Now, whose job is it? It's the House's job to originate impeachment. It's the Senate's job to try it. So when we say Hillary Clinton should have been impeached, where does the responsibility lie? It relies on Congress. Congress fucked up and they've abdicated their responsibility. You know, they can actually still impeach her after the fact. And what it would do...
She couldn't hold office anymore. She couldn't be a political...
It would keep her from holding office in the future. She wouldn't be a threat on our side anymore.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, so we're going to go through the... You want to go through the vice president?
I think the only important thing that we really got to talk about the vice president, which is kind of interesting, is that originally in the Constitution, the vice president was the second popular vote. The second vote in
so
the electoral
So it would be
system.
Hillary and Donald right now. Hillary would be vice president. Yeah, that's hilarious.
Essentially, yeah. Hillary would be vice president. The 12th Amendment changed that, and it required that they run separate. You run a candidacy for president, and then you run a candidacy for vice president. You hold elections for each. And but one thing that's weird, and that they stopped ever since Franklin D. Roosevelt and World War II changed the face of the nation for the worse. He just appointed his vice president. They didn't hold an election, a separate election. The 12th Amendment, which still holds to this day, says you're supposed to have two different elections, one for president, one for vice president. We don't do that now.
No,
now,
yeah.
He just gets to appoint him, and then everybody votes for the couple of them, right?
Yeah.
It's another way that we've fucked up the system.
Damn it.
So, you could talk about the powers of the vice president.
The presidential succession?
So the powers of the vice president, we talked, he presides over the Senate, and in the line of presidential succession, he becomes president if the president dies. Get into presidential succession.
Presidential succession is the system of presidential succession provides a simple, I'm sorry, the system of presidential succession provides a simple and rapid method of filling the office of president in the event of the president's death or inability to serve. The method of presidential succession takes authority from Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, the 20th and 25th Amendments, and the Presidential Succession Law of 1947. The current order of presidential succession
we
is...
We can just do maybe like... Yeah, six or seven of these, because this is the whole succession. If the president dies, who it goes down to, and it goes through his cabinet at the very end of it.
Yeah, so it's basically vice president, speaker of the house, president pro tempore of the senate, and secretary of state, secretary of treasury, secretary of defense, and attorney general. A lot of these sound kind of funny though.
Other than that, it's like, dude, really? Like, when is the
secretary of labor, agriculture? Yeah. Commerce.
When is the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development going to become president, you know?
But Homeland Security's last.
Yeah, good.
And Veterans Affairs is up before that, and then education.
Yeah.
So
it's just kind of funny. So,
yeah.
So just other than that is that the president can appoint his cabinet. And that's the executive branch is... The by far the most, how it was designed, the most powerful branch was supposed to be the legislative branch. And of those, the most powerful was supposed to be the House. And that represented the people. Because they have the power of the purse. What has become the most powerful branch, it's tough to say. They've all gotten out of hand. But if you look at the executive branch... The executive branch and all of the departments and cabinets directly under the president's control, totally foregoing the legislative process or the judicial process, is insane. He's supposed to have, you know, his cabinet, which is supposed to be 15 executive agencies, but it's gotten out of hand. The president's cabinet is composed of the heads or secretaries of the 15 executive branch agencies under the direct control of the president. The secretaries are appointed by the president and must be confirmed by a simple majority vote of the Senate. So that all makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
That he's got his cabinet. But, I mean, on the next episode that we're going to do as an addendum to this episode, we talk about how shit's gotten out of hand. One of the big ones is at the end of World War II, Truman created a whole thing called national security. And under national security, you had the CIA formed, you had the National Security Council, you had this huge thing that has now developed into a monster that is not accountable to
government
the
growth.
And they can create, they can make money their own ways. That's why we see the CIA doing drug dealing.
Mm-hmm.
So they could be making trillions of dollars, and we find that they're doing operations in almost every country, fomenting revolutions, doing all this stuff. That's all under the executive branch, created under the veil of national security after World War II. It's insane how crazy the executive branch has gotten. But it's crazy how crazy all of the branches have gotten. But you know, if we don't teach this stuff, nobody knows. And everybody just watches Fox News and thinks, oh, yeah, CIA? No, cool.
Yeah, they're good. They're good guys.
Yeah. Not, you know, I don't know, man. There's a lot of evidence to say those guys should be shut down. And what JFK was trying to do with them was probably the right thing. At least, maybe if not shut them down, to completely limit them to... Even Truman said, after he got out of office, he said, the CIA should be limited to intelligence only, gathering intelligence only. You know, now you got the NSA spying on everybody, and it's just crazy, but all done under the veil of national security, you know?
Yep, but you call it, give it a cool name, and people's, yeah, Patriot.
Well, it sounds
we want to be Patriots. Well,
Federal Reserve?
Patriot Act? Yeah, it's feds. Federal,
National
yeah.
Defense Authorization Act sounds totally cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Affordable health care? Yeah. Who doesn't want that?
All right, let's take a quick break, and then we'll continue. What do you think?
Sounds good.
A rat.
Rock. Is that Fitzins at Tantrums?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
You're good, man. You are good.
Well, I remember you used to bag on those guys. But they're good. They're
yeah.
Guys and gals.
They're the ones that do Money Grabber.
Yeah.
That's the song that YouTube sent us a notice on.
Oh.
Money Grabber, don't come back anytime. YouTube sent us a notice saying that...
we're dicks.
Our upload on our YouTube channel of our Silver Manipulation number one episode... may be censored in some countries because of our copyright content.
Censorship. That's so it'll keep everyone safe and sane, right?
Do you know what we do?
That's what'll keep the peace. Censor people.
If you guys have wondered why we feel like we have the right to play other people's songs on our podcast, I absolutely do. I don't believe that people can hold on to intellectual property, or else nobody would have ever built anything in history. It just doesn't work like that. Geniuses stand on the shoulders of other geniuses throughout history. They build upon each other. And I'm not saying we're geniuses, but that's what we're using songs to help illustrate what we're doing.
And we like music.
Additionally, well, there's two other things. Is you can use other people's content if you're doing it for educational purposes only, and you're not making money off of it. We're not making money. This is a absolutely non-profit endeavor that we're doing. No. So three different ways it's right. It's right morally, and it's right legally, and it's right financially. I'm not stealing anything from these guys. We're using it for educational purposes.
And not only that, but like I would imagine if I was in a band or I was a musical artist and somebody wanted to play my music on a show that who knows who could hear it. Like,
yep.
My goal also, like you were saying, is for educational purposes, but like get good bands out there, good music out there.
Yeah. There's actually a law that's written, and I think it's called the Fair Use Act. That's what it's called. The Fair Use Act. And under the Fair Use Act, if you use content for educational purposes only, you can actually reproduce people's work. Excerpts of writings in books. That kind of stuff. And that's, we absolutely feel free to do that. And we're going to keep doing that. Mm-hmm. We're going to absolutely keep doing that. And I'd like, if you guys have any debates against that, I would love to debate that, because Nick knows. I've looked into that, and we don't blindly play other people's music thinking that we can do that. We've looked into this issue a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Legally and morally, and I feel absolutely fine doing that. But YouTube says that in some countries, that episode might be censored on YouTube. So that's interesting. Fits in the Tantrums was that one.
Because the government knows what's better for you.
Yes.
What you can handle.
Yeah.
Intellectually.
Yeah. Intellectual property, which is crazy. But. So,
well, if we've learned anything from Footloose, is dancing is the devil, and rock and roll will send you to hell.
It sounds,
I just
like got to
dance,
madness.
Man.
And yours. So we were just talking about the executive branch and the powers of the president. So we should have a separation of powers, but there are actually legislative powers that the office of the president actually has. We're going to talk about that. The president of the United States is commonly referred to as the most powerful person in the free world. But the legislative powers of the president are strictly defined by the Constitution and by a system of checks and balances among the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government. Although it is the responsibility of Congress to introduce and pass legislation, it is the president's duty to either approve those bills or reject them. So he does have a legislative capacity in that regard. Once the president signs a bill into law, it goes immediately into effect unless there is another effective date noted. Only the Supreme Court may remove the law by declaring it unconstitutional. Bullshit. Just saying.
Mm-hmm.
We already talked about that, though.
Yeah.
The president may also issue a signing statement at the time he signs a bill. The presidential signing statement may simply explain the purpose of the bill, instruct the responsible executive branch agencies on how the law should be administered, or express the president's opinion of the law's constitutionality. In addition, the actions of the presidents have contributed to the five quote-unquote other ways the Constitution has been amended over the years. Vetoing legislation. The president may also veto a specific bill which Congress can override with a two-thirds majority of the numbers of members present in both the Senate and the House when the override is taken. Whichever chamber of Congress originated the bill may also rewrite the legislation after the veto and send it back to the president for approval. The president has a third option, which is to do nothing. In this case, two things can happen. and we talked about this, but we'll just talk about it again. If Congress is in session at any point within a period of 10 business days after the president receives the bill, it automatically becomes law. If Congress does not convene within 10 days, the bill dies and Congress cannot override it. This is known as a pocket veto. There are two ways that presidents can enact initiatives without congressional approval. Presidents may issue a proclamation, often ceremonial in nature, such as naming a day in honor of somebody or something that has contributed to American society. The president may also issue an executive order, which has the full effect of law and is directed to federal agencies that are charged with carrying out the order. Examples include Franklin D. Roosevelt's executive order for the internment of Japanese Americans.
Yeah, I went over this one, dude.
What's that?
I already read all this stuff.
Yeah, they're just kind of describing it again. After the attack on Pearl Harbor, Harry Truman's integration of the armed forces and Dwight Eisenhower's order to integrate the nation's schools. Congress cannot directly vote to override an executive order in the way that they can veto. Instead, Congress must pass a bill canceling or changing the order in a manner they see fit. The president will typically veto that bill, and then Congress can try to override the veto of that second bill. The Supreme Court can also declare an executive order to be unconstitutional. Congressional cancellation of an order is extremely rare. The president's legislative agenda. Once a year, the president is required to provide the full Congress with a State of the Union address. At this time, the president often lays out his legislative agenda for the next year, outlining his legislative priorities for both Congress and the nation at large. In order to help get this legislative agenda passed by Congress, the president will often ask a specific lawmaker to sponsor bills and lobby other members for passage. Members of the president's staff, such as the vice president, his chief of staff, or other liaisons with Capitol Hill will also lobby. But that's the official version of the president's legislative powers, you know, like executive orders. But executive orders were really only put in the Constitution so that George Washington could say, I need more paper clips. And he'd get more paper clips. Like, that was supposed to be an executive order that's been absolutely abused throughout the years. Another way. So, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from Bill Cooper, who I am a huge fan of. He, in his book, Behold a Pale Horse, he wrote this about...
horses?
About this subject.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. With... all the people involved with these laws, like we were talking about earlier, how long it takes to go through. Don't you think it's weird that there's not more, like we went through the list of recommendations, I'm sorry, what it takes to become a president, like 35 years old, you got to be born in America naturally, right?
Yeah, naturalized citizen.
But I mean, like right now, we got a real estate agent who's now going to be president. And the guy before him was a fucking community organizer. So a guy that was like, this weekend we'll have a bingo night. And Friday will be men's softball.
Yeah.
So we have a community organizer. We have a fucking real estate agent who, you know, has a reality, you know, hits a reality TV show. Yeah. But wouldn't it behoove us to have guys or gals, whoever, who came through the House, came through these Senates, that have seen how these bills are passed and the effects of, like, how long it takes. Like, right now, I mean, who knows what bills they're trying to get passed.
Ron Paul would have been perfect.
Who knows what bills they've been trying to get passed for fucking years. Ron Paul and now you got a new guy that's just going to be like, fuck that, and not even know the consequences of them. Like, are they going through a learning curve right now? Do they have to, like, teach... Trump, how to, you know, okay, yes. Now this yes, is how government works.
Absolutely.
And this is
that.
What you're going to be dealing with. Yeah. And this is what a pocket fucking veto is and all that.
Yep.
So, you know?
Yes. Yeah, he's got to go through all that. He also has to get debriefed from the national security team of all the things that they deem fit that he should be able to know.
Yeah.
He can't even know all of it.
So right now we're murdering these people for this oil in this area. And they have these natural resources, so we're murdering their people.
They're like, right now we're conducting these experiments that are going to tear the fabric of reality apart, much like a nuclear bomb, but it's going to tear a hole in time-space dimension.
And you're in charge of it now. And you get to say when we push the button. And it's all going to go on you when we do demolish it, whatever kind.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's gotten pretty crazy. Like, I agree with Kennedy when he says that only the thinnest veil of national security really should exist. Aside from that, if it's national security, you know, like, I don't believe in aliens, but if alien disclosure was a thing, that's not national security. That needs to be laid to the people, what they find in that, right? Scientific things need to be laid to the people. National security is, you know, like where our forces are at in a battle, what the plan of attack is if we're at war with another country. Like, you know, there's certain things that need to be national, you know, national security. You know, I would say even maybe some technology in regards to weaponry, if we don't want other people to have it, maybe, but. That's just me kind of brainstorming. I don't know. So what Bill Cooper wrote about further executive legislative powers, he said, Congress has tremendous powers, but fails in most cases to exercise even a token amount. How is it that our legislature has allowed and at times encouraged the executive branch to write law? You probably did not know that the president and others in the executive branch of the government can and do write law. This is done in the form of presidential executive orders, National Security Council memos, National Security Decision Directives, and National Security Directives. All of those are different categories of the way, really, that the executive branch can and does write laws, not just the president. Which is interesting. So I could get into who the executive cabinet is right now. It doesn't really matter. Secretary of State doesn't really matter other than, you know, who Trump's cabinet is. And I think we've covered the whole government structure there. I think we've done a good job at that.
And like you said, we could build later on, on, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we're coming kind of close to the end of the show. There is, we probably have about 20, 30 minutes left. Do you want to do a song and come back? We're done with the governmental structure information. So if you guys just signed on for that, then you can go ahead and show's over for you. What I wanted to get into was a new news article. There's a piece of legislation that was passed this last week that I just have to talk about because the freedom of speech has really been killing me lately. And so I'm going to discuss this. I think I want to do it with a fresh mind. So let's take a break. And when we come back, we will talk about that. Okay.
Dwelling on all that's become of you, and I want the truth. Now that we're locked down to this chance to figure things out, how did it turn us?
is Locked Down by Senet. Locked Down by Senet. If you guys like what they have, show them love. Give them a buck. Buy their shit for a buck. God. You could find that much money in your seat cushions. It kills me what everybody wants for free nowadays.
For one Federal Reserve note.
Yeah, that's true. One Federal Reserve note. Until, you know, the system changes. It goes slow. Peter Schiff just introduced a new company he's involved in called Gold Money, where you can actually get you can upload money from your account. It buys gold, and then you have a MasterCard that spends that money. Hmm. But it converts it. If gold skyrocketed, your account would have double the amount of money overnight. So you're actually buying and using gold with it. Nice. They've got all these cool new things that are coming out, and I really hope that trend continues. Guys, if we can hold it together for like 20 more years, I think we can actually like really probably do this freedom thing, but we got to hold it together, and we can't let these fucks take over. They're trying hard right now. So this is where I'm going to get a little bit sentimental, because I do, as much as I think that the Second Amendment is absolutely important to retaining our freedoms, it's vital. I am really starting to think that more importantly, the First Amendment and the freedom of speech is more important, and that the manipulation of language,
political correctness
and the censoring of information, that this is actually the first attack on us, and it's being done big time right now. I don't know if you guys have noticed. You might not be watching the news, and good for you if you're not, but what the one of the major stories in the past month is fake news. They're saying that Russia hacked our elections, and they determined the outcome based off of fake news stories, because everybody's going to all the Americans are going to the internet for fake news, and they're getting told by the Russians a bunch of bullshit, and so they voted for Trump. That's what our government is telling us now. So we are in crazy times right now, because technically, my opinion, the Russians should be able to tell us stuff. You know, and it's up to you whether to check out if it's true or not. But RT has brought a lot of good content. They're exposing a lot of stuff, and I can't find a whole lot of lies in RT's content. RT is doing it intelligently. Now, don't get me wrong. Russia is a scandalous country. They're socialist, and they have bad, bad agendas for America. Let me just get that straight. I'm not a fan of Putin. I'm not a fan of Russia. I'm a fan of the Constitution and freedom to do that here. But our government is fucking around, and they're doing a lot of shady shit, and they should be called out on their shit. So when they get called out by RT in Russia, they get mad now because they think it changed the election. They think they swung it in Trump's favor. And it may have, but
I think it's weird that you're considered a criminal when you bring out these things. Like Snowden is living in hiding when he brought out facts
because he violated laws.
But I mean,
national security laws. He belonged to the National Security Administration, which falls under the national security veil under the executive branch, and they've got their own set of laws. He violated them, and now he's a criminal. But those laws and that whole system should never even have existed, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you have dirt on Obama or Hillary or whatever it is, if it's the truth, let's see it. You know?
Yeah.
They have no problem blowing everybody else's dirty water out of, you know, and exploiting people. But if it's a truth about the government, you're considered a criminal?
Yeah, now you're considered a criminal. Yeah, for sure. WikiLeaks, the same thing.
When speaking the truth is considered a crime, you live in a tyrannical form of government.
The weird thing about WikiLeaks that I
looked into is like their track record on accuracy in their reporting, because they put some bombshells out. Every single one of their stories they put out have been verified to be true.
Mm-hmm.
They don't put out bullshit. Now, it's not that we should accept everything they put out in the future is true. That's not what I'm saying.
No, yeah, they could.
They could start leading people astray. I don't necessarily trust them, but their track record is excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't verified some of the other stuff that they've done, but like the Pizzagate thing is pretty creepy. Crazy.
Yeah.
I haven't validated it, but it's absolutely crazy. You know, its implications are nuts. It would support what we're saying. Have you heard of the Pizzagate?
Yes. Thing? Child molestation, but they had actual like code names.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for different sexual acts or different type of kids. Yeah.
That's where, to me, it almost feels like a media trap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're trying to trap with this fake news thing. They're trying to trap alternative sources of media as reporting false stories. And
if you're not mainstream, how could you know it's real? You know, but it's called journalism, investigative journalism, which you don't see anymore.
You will need to apply for a license in order to be a licensed media person if you have over a certain amount of followers. And they've done that in other countries. Other countries, there's somebody just passed a law. I want to say it's India, but where they said if you have over 10,000 followers on your social media account, you have to apply for a license in order to be declared by the state to be like an official.
Because you're a threat to the state. Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, but what if you're a kid writing a book report? You're just asking questions, just like investigative journalism. Like,
yeah. Just and asking, you have a lot of followers.
Yeah.
You have to do that. So what's weird is, remember how we said the internet is changing the face of the world? This is the new Gutenberg press. This is the new printing press. The old world was led by the Catholic Church, had domination over all the kings in Europe. The printing press changed that because now they could print the Bible and everybody could read what was in the Bible and they could see that the Catholic Church was lying about it. And it crumbled the power of the Catholic Church, an invention. So what we find is throughout history, inventions tend to crumble major power structures that are being built up. Well, we have a major power structure that was being built up, and then we have the internet that comes around. Now everybody can freely communicate and be able to do all this stuff. We got WikiLeaks, we got hackers doing all this stuff. And it's crumbling things. It's crumbling things. And now you and me and people like us, we're talking about it. And this is their fight back, is the fake news thing.
Yeah. But I would imagine people are smart enough to investigate themselves. Like, you know, I've read a
sure, but what,
news.
What happens
I've read
when news you and me have no voice? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And I'm not saying everything I say is right. I'm just curious about things I see on television or what we're told. And I'm sorry, but I'm a curious person. I'm going to question it.
Yep.
You know, I've seen some of these articles on like Twitter or whatever, and it's like something stupid. It's like, no, that's fucking bullshit. Yeah, we got to be able to decipher bullshit or not.
Yep.
But what's sad now is we've created a society with the political correctness and everything else where it's like, nobody can even take a fucking joke. They don't even have a sense of humor anymore, you know? Yeah,
true. That's another thing that people are going to need that in their toolkit going into the future is a way to decipher truth from bullshit. And you and me did an episode about the Trivium method. And if you guys want, look back in our history of shows. It's the Trivium method, and if you don't find what you are looking for on our episode, because we only glanced over it, look it up yourself. The Trivium is a method of sifting through bullshit, finding lies. Oh, we called it, the episode was called Thank God It's Fallacies.
Mm-hmm.
So if you guys want, look up Thank God It's Fallacies, because the Trivium method is the Greek method of of deciphering truth from bullshit. And then through that trivia method, you can derive a bunch of these logical fallacies, like appeal to authority, appeal to popularity, appeal to emotions, name calling, that kind of stuff. So I can't get into it. We got to continue. But if you guys want to, refer back to our Thank God It's Fallacies show, and you'll get a lot out of that. Just to equip them with the tools needed to decipher some of the bullshit, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm for free market capitalism, and I think what the media that's telling us about fake news is telling us now, you know, whether it be MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, it could be anybody, CNN, you know, your main media outlets, they see competition. With the internet and this and that, people are like...
Yeah, but it's not just commercial competition. Those guys are in cahoots with the CIA.
Yeah, but I mean, there's actual video footage of these companies that are talking about fake news setting up caution tape up on like mic booms, like they're at the crime scene and talking about it. You know, there's I've seen other videos where people just run into the street and lay down, and there's a big explosion, and then the media comes runs in. Oh my gosh, here we are! There's the explosion in the dirt.
Wow.
Out here, like where we live, California, you get a little bit of fucking rain, and it's a big goddamn deal. You know,
it's an emergency.
It's a 1 inch of rain. Oh my gosh! And you'll sit there and watch these fucking idiots take their video camera and stick it in the gutter to make it look like the water's larger than it is.
Yeah.
So is that real? So it's like, or is it? Hey, how about you just drive a little fucking safer and you're going to get a little wet?
Yeah.
Big fucking deal.
Anybody.
You're not in a fucking any danger. But I hate the news that we deal with, our local news. It's freak out all the fucking time, you know?
Nick, I honestly think that anybody going into these future years, being able to decipher truth from bullshit, along with being just a hardy, tough person, is going to be like king over everybody else. Not that that's what you want to be, but if you really want to equip yourself, do those things, you know, like, and you will, you're just going to be so much more equipped to deal with the future than anybody else. It's going to be invaluable to you having those skills. Like, let me do this.
Yep.
Okay. So this is from, this is an article out of from Zero Hedge from December 26th of 2016, this year. This is the day after Christmas. It's entitled, Obama Quietly Signs the Countering Disinformation and Propaganda Act into Law. So, I just want you guys to know, he signed this into law.
He's against propaganda. Good for him.
Yeah, right.
Greatest president.
So, I just want everybody to know that these bills that he signed into law were introduced this year before all the fake news stories and the fake news theme blew up in the mainstream media. These were introduced in March of this year. They were written, the bills were written, they were ready to go by March of this year. And then they came out in the media afterwards. I just want everybody to know that. That's very important that people understand the way things work in the media. So, through executive action, Obama passed the 2017 National Defense Authorization Act. Okay, and that was no surprise to anybody. Because every year he's passed the National Defense Authorization Act, he's just expanded its capabilities or not. But the interesting thing about this one is embedded into this 2017 National Defense Authorization Act is both H.R. 5181, which now we know is House Resolution 5181, and Senate Bill 2692. It's the same version. It's but when you get those committees in conference that have to make them jive together, It's the same. That's what it is. Okay. Isn't it so much nicer to know this stuff now, though?
Mm-hmm.
Now that I
otherwise like, it's just weird letters, and you're just like,
I never knew that prior to doing the research for this show. So now I'm able to read these articles. I go, oh, that's S-2943 that arose in the Senate. That's HR, you know, 5181 that arose in the House. And they, you know, I just love learning, understanding things more. It makes your consciousness bigger. So late on Friday, with the U.S. population embracing the upcoming holidays and oblivious of most news emerging from the administration, Obama quietly signed into law the 2017 National Defense Authorization Act, which authorizes $611 billion for the military in 2017. So basically, Obama has this big speech, and I'll save you guys from it. If you want, go to the Zero Hedge article. But basically, he said that he is increasing funds to be able to battle the Islamic State in Iraq and Levant and a bunch of the threats that we have here at home, expand our Department of Defense and Energy, more flexibility in countering cyber attacks. This is how they word shit. But you guys got to know the stuff that they embedded into this. So we expected that out of the administration to expand their military funding, right? But while the passage of the NDAA and the funding of the U.S. military was hardly a surprise, the biggest news is what was buried deep inside the provisions of the Defense Authorization Act. And deep inside was the H.R. 5181, which was introduced in June of this year into H.R. would have been the House. And this was called Countering Foreign Propaganda and Disinformation Act of 2016. And it called for whole government approach without bureaucratic restrictions to counter foreign disinformation and manipulation, which they believe threaten the world's security and stability. In the Senate, it was called the Countering Information Warfare Act of 2016. That's S-2692. That was introduced in March by Senator Robert Portman. And it said, these countries spend vast sums of money on advanced broadcast and digital media capabilities, talking about Russia, targeted campaigns, funding of foreign political movements, and other efforts to influence key audiences and populations. Portman explained, adding that while the U.S. spends a relatively small amount on its Voice of America, the Kremlin provides enormous funding for its news organization, RT. Okay. Surprisingly, Portman continued, there is currently no single U.S. government agency or department charged with the national level development, integration, and synchronization of whole of government strategies to counter foreign propaganda and disinformation. That's because we live in a free state. So, long before the fake news meme became a daily topic of extensive conversation on such discredited mainstream portals as CNN and Washington Post, H.R. 5181 would task the Secretary of State with coordinating the Secretary of Defense, the Director of National Intelligence, and the Broadcasting Board of Governors to establish a Center for Information Analysis and Response, which will pinpoint sources of disinformation, analyze data, and, in true dystopic manner, develop and disseminate fact-based narratives to counter effrontery propaganda. In short, long before fake news became a major media topic, the U.S. government was already planning its legally backed crackdown on anything it would eventually label fake news. Okay? And then it gets disseminated into the media. That's how it happens, people. Fast forward to December 8th, while the Countering Disinformation and Propaganda Act passed in the Senate. But it couldn't pass on its own. It was quietly inserted inside of the 2017 National Defense Authorization Act. And now, following Friday's Obama's signing of the National Defense Authorization Act, the Countering Disinformation and Propaganda Act is now law. It's now law. I'm only going to go a few more minutes and then I'll stop, okay? Just stay with me just a little bit longer, people. U.S. Senators Rob Portman and Chris Murphy today announced that their Countering Disinformation and Propaganda Act legislation designed to help American allies counter foreign government propaganda from Russia, China, and other nations has been signed into law as part of the FY 2017 National Defense Authorization Act conference report. The bipartisan bill, which was introduced by Senators Portman and Murphy in March, will improve the ability of the United States to counter foreign propaganda and disinformation from our enemies by establishing an interagency center housed at the State Department to coordinate and synchronize counter-propaganda efforts through the U.S. government. To support these efforts, the bill also creates a grant program for NGOs, think tanks, civil society, and other experts outside the government who are engaged in counter-propaganda-related work. This will better leverage existing expertise and empower our allies overseas to defend themselves from foreign manipulation. It will also help foster a free and vibrant press and civil society overseas, which is critical to ensuring our allies have access to truthful information and inoculating people against foreign propaganda campaigns. So that's just their statement. They also said, with this bill now law, we are finally signaling that enough is enough. The United States will no longer sit on the sidelines. We are going to confront this threat head on. I am confident that with the help of this bipartisan bill, the disinformation and propaganda used against us, our allies, and interests will fail. So, there are two main things that this bill actually says in it. The first part says how they're going to use the government to battle propaganda, and the second part is how they're going to use public or private companies to do it.
Didn't Hitler burn books? Because yes, he didn't want separate types of thinking. He didn't want alternate types of thinking, alternate thoughts.
Yes, he did. And look at what George Orwell did in 1984, at what he said, how they had the Ministry of Truth.
The cycle continues.
Yeah. So on the government side of things, it's going to mandate the Global Engagement Center, whatever that is, the Global Engagement Center, the State Department, the Department of Defense, USAID, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, the intelligence community, and other relevant agencies to develop, integrate, and synchronize initiatives to expose disinformation operations. The second part is that private institutions will establish a fund to help train local journalists and provide grants and contracts to NGOs, which is non-governmental organizations, civil society organizations, think tanks, private sector companies, media organizations, and other experts outside the United States government. So let me read this Zero Hedge little synopsis of all this information because I think it's good. And so, with the likes of Washington Post having already primed the general public to equate Russian propaganda with fake news, despite admitting after the fact their own report was essentially fake, while the U.S. media has indoctrinated the public in, to assume that any information which is not in compliance with the official government narrative or dares to criticize the establishment is also fake news, and thus falls under the Russian propaganda umbrella. The scene is now set for the U.S. government to legally crack down on every media outlet that the government deems to be foreign propaganda. And just like that, the U.S. Ministry of Truth is officially born, and that's a reference to 1984. Nick, unless you have anything else, I'm disgusted with the passage of this law. That is Obama absolutely saying, you do not have freedom of speech. He is attacking this podcast with that.
It's okay. Just let the government tell you how to think, what to think.
Yep.
They have your best interests.
Keep doing nothing,
let them take 70% of your fucking paycheck. It's just going to get better, everybody.
If you listen to this, we've been telling you guys this for over a year now, and we mean it. If you think this information is important, study and teach. Study and teach. Study and teach. Get your voice out there, please. And so I'm going to, unless you have anything else, we'll just close it. So remember, guys, if you don't speak out, we can't hear you. And what we're also going to do is this professor that you're going to hear, he's being persecuted right now because in his classes, he refuses to use gender-specific pronouns. He's okay with he, she, but when people come up to him and say, no, you have to use Z, I am, and these are people that, say they identify themselves as different genders. And the reason I'm introducing this right now is because we're eventually going to do a show about political correctness, the Frankfurt School, and how they are killing our language with writing their own language, the left is. And so he's being persecuted and punished at his work for not using these gender-specific pronouns. They're checking freedom of speech. They're saying you must say these things.
Yeah. You cannot say that. You can't say someone's retarded. You can't say they're a lesbian or a dyke or a fucking fag or
whatever.
They're
attacking his freedom of speech. Now, we think that's ridiculous and it could never happen here. Think again. Things are getting crazy. University of Oxford, University of Toronto, have both written laws in which their employees must use these terms. The city of Ontario.
I have it at my work. It's a
it's coming big time.
The it's city a, call of, it a we have a policy of equity.
It's watch it. And so can, do we.
Yeah.
Watch it's going to get crazier. It's going to go as far as these.
You have protected people like
classes.
If you protected classes.
Yep.
And what is that doing for you? All you want to do is come and do your fucking job. Nobody gives a fuck who you want to fuck or suck or whatever.
Ultimately, it's going to come down to controlling your speech.
Yeah.
So the city of Ontario.
And don't hurt feelings. Don't hurt anybody's feelings.
The city of Ontario, the city of Washington, D.C., and New York City have all written laws requiring their employees to use gender-specific pronouns, which means that if somebody does not identify as a he or a she or trans, you must ask them. And if they say, I am neutois, then you must refer to them as neutois. You must. And if you don't, you are in the wrong and you get punished.
And how's that making society better? Like,
it's not. It's an absolute attack on Western culture. And I'll get into how that works. It gets into the Frankfurt School, and they know that by attacking language, you can blast the foundations from under Western civilization culture. So that's what he's talking about here. This guy is actually in trouble because he's a professor. This dude's one of the smartest guys. He's one of my, aside from Bill Cooper, now this guy's my hero. His name's Jordan Peterson, if you guys want to look. He has taken this cause head on, and he's gotten persecuted big time for it. But he says he's not going to use those pronouns. He's not going to use made up words, you know? So, other than that, we bid you guys adieu. We, of course, always think that you guys should own a little bit of silver and gold just to keep yourself safe. If you do, call Swiss America Trading. They've treated us very well. They're not in support of everything we say, so they're not official sponsors. But tell them that you heard about them on the Beacon podcast and ask for Gary Belson. Okay. Other than that, we'll leave you guys there. Nick, if you got anything else?
Thanks for downloading. We love you. And keep on educating yourself, and we love the feedback.
Love it, guys. Thank you so much. Another episode of Beacon Podcast down.
Get to the chopper.
Well, why would I put my job on the line to have an opinion about compelled pronouns? I know why. Because the ability to speak your truth is the bulwark against hell. And losing your job? That's nothing. That's nothing compared to where things can go when they go badly. For me, it was just preventative. It's like, this isn't going in a good direction. Well, should you take a risk? It's like, you don't have that choice. You're silent? That's a risk. Now, most people don't understand the risks of silence. I happen to understand the risks of silence because I've been studying them for 40 years.
Is it frustrating for you to get so little support for these actions and for your protests?
Well, I wouldn't say that that's what happened.
And I don't mean so little support, because you're getting a lot of support outside of the university.
It's okay. It doesn't matter where the support comes from. Like, I mean, it's disappointing in the same way that it's disappointing for me to say, I think the universities now do more harm than good. That's disappointing. But it's not surprising to me. It isn't as if intellectuals are characterized by an intrinsic moral superiority. Oh, they're smart, so they'll leap to the defense of what's right. It's like, no, there's no evidence for that. Intelligence and moral wisdom aren't the same thing. Like, and if you're corrupt and smart, all that makes you is way more treacherous. It doesn't make you less likely to be corrupt. It just makes you much more, you're 50 snakes instead of two. Or you're 56-headed snakes instead of two. Like, I've had clients who had very serious personality disorders, who were very intelligent. It's like, that's not necessarily a good thing for them. They're just better at arguing for their pathology to themselves.
That is a real problem, where people automatically assume that intelligent people are going to be healthy.
Yeah, well, they're healthy in that often they do better in the world, you know, because their
successful.
Skills are, yes, their
right.
skills are more marketable and so on. But there's no evidence that there's any relationship between intelligence and morality. I mean, God, let me tell you a story, man. One time I had this client. This woman was just ruined. She looked like a street person, you know, and she had very dirty clothes. And she was so shy that she couldn't even approach you. She had to shield her eyes from you as if you were emitting light. And she did that to everyone on the street. Like, she was bent over and humble, like a Chinese peasant brought before the emperor, you know. And one of the things I was doing with her in behavior therapy was trying to just get her to present herself in a more normal manner so that people wouldn't shy away from her and, you know, be instantly prejudiced towards her. And she'd come to the behavior therapy clinic. And she wasn't bright, this woman. I think she had only had like a seventh grade education. She was quite intellectually impaired. And she lived with her sick aunt who was schizophrenic and who had a satanically possessed alcoholic boyfriend that was always tormenting my client. She lived in absolute hell. But she had this dog, and she used to take it out and walk the dog all the time. And then she'd actually come to the behavior therapy clinic, partly because of her own problem, but she'd come to this place called the Douglas Hospital, and she'd been an inpatient in the Douglas Hospital. And in the Douglas Hospital, there were these long-term psychiatric clients, and they looked like something out of a Hieronymus Bosch painting or Dante's Inferno. I mean, these people were, this is way worse than One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. These people were seriously destroyed, and they couldn't be let back out on the streets during deinstitutionalization. Like, they were lifers. And she had decided that part of the reason she wanted to come to the hospital was because she had been institutionalized there, and she thought that maybe when she took her dog out for a walk, she could go and get one of those damn inmates and take them out for a walk too. Now, that was a person who was moral. dumb as a post, just screwed in 50 different directions. Nothing going for her. And she had the bloody moral capacity to decide that there was someone worse off than her. And believe me, that wasn't easy to find. And that maybe she could do them some good if the hospital would let her. Which they didn't, by the way. Yeah, well, that's the story of the soul. That's not the intellect, that's for sure. So I didn't expect any support from my colleagues. And it isn't that I don't care if I got it, but it's in some sense, it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant to me, because my goal was, I'm not saying those goddamn pronouns. And the reason I'm not saying them is because they're made up by left-wing ideologues. And I don't like left-wing ideology. I don't like ideology, period. And I know where corruption of speech leads. And I'm not going there. And, you know, one of the things I tried to learn when I was taking apart what happened in Auschwitz and trying to put myself in the position of an Auschwitz camp guard, which, by the way, you can do if you use your imagination a bit. I wouldn't call it exactly the world's most pleasant meditative experience, but you can call up parts of yourself that would be capable of taking someone who just got off a transport train and having them carry a 100-pound sack of wet salt from one side of the camp compound to the other and back. You can conjure that part of yourself up if you want, and that'll teach you something about what you're like. People don't do it because it's too frightening, but I know perfectly well that I could do that sort of thing. And so once I learned that I could do that sort of thing, and maybe that I could even enjoy it, I thought, okay, fine, I get it. I'm going to see if I can figure out how to live so that if that opportunity was presented to me, I wouldn't take it. And I think that's the lesson that people need to learn from the 20th century. It's like, that's what human beings did, okay? Well, we're all human, okay? So how is it that we should live so that we don't do that again? Well, part of that is to try to say the truth, no matter what, because the alternative is worse. And it is worse.
The truth, no matter what, and that is the real problem that you see with being forced into using these made-up pronouns.
Yeah, absolutely. It's my language. I'll take responsibility for what I say.
Go celebrate what you like.